For those listening to KSBN Money Talk Radio who might be interested in buying physical precious metals for less than what I can pay for them, stay tuned. I have a way you can support this show and secure what I believe is the best price for precious metals on the existing market. In our first commercial break, I will explain this in more detail. And now, let's get on with Reclaiming the Republic. Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. If you go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org, you can download our podcast and support documents and links. This is an educational, grassroots program designed to restore the Republic and placing the general government, or what many refer to as the federal government, back into the constitutional framework and scope of the Constitution. This is not going to be an open show for you to call. I know that I probably have more people that want to call into this show than any other show broadcasted today or in our current time. However, I have to constrain all of you that still have those desires. Please don't call in. I'm going to have a very special pre-recorded guest. It's Dr. Vile, and this is segment, I think, two, and then we'll have a third segment next week where we've had this long conversation of what does academia present as the solution for fixing our constitutional crisis that we're literally living in. And so I'm not going to give you the number to call in. And if you cannot listen to this show in its entirety, it will be rebroadcasted this Saturday after the Whitworth game. So just tune into the game and then just strap on, because you are going to have a ride for your life. I'll just inject this right now before I get into the local announcements. I want you to understand that I've never had anybody on their own, cognitive process say, hey, you can't do this. This is unconstitutional. You will be arrested. You know, this is treasonous or what have you. Absolutely not. What I am asserting is well within the bounds and exactly what Madison and Jefferson had asserted. That's why I'm not the genius here. I'm just the guy that found their words and just basically put it together for everybody else to be able to start following what the framers gave us and what the framers did. Anyway, that's why it's really important to listen to these shows and listen to all of the shows so you can start garnering what the framers really did say and put it all together. So don't forget, you can download these podcasts from ReclaimingTheRepublic.org on the podcast link. Councilman Ed Pace will be hosting his town hall meetings at the following locations: on Wednesday, 9 a.m. at McDonald's on University and Sprague, and Friday, 9 a.m. at Forza Coffee on Sullivan and 4th, and Saturday, 8 a.m. at Rosar's on University and Sprague. The Republican Coffee Club this Friday will be having former City Councilman Mike Allen on entrepreneurship, and on the 22nd, Jake McCullough, who is from the Institute on the Constitution, will be speaking. He is also speaking for the Constitution Day event, and those details will be, you can just go to Reclaiming the Republic, and you can look for it on Facebook. They will be having an event, and forgive me for not having the venue here in front of me. This is my bad, but it will be on the 21st, on Thursday night. And as a matter of fact, really my bad, because I'm actually going to have books there, and you can come and buy books, and the proceeds, half of the proceeds, so if you buy a set of books for $45, half of that goes to the Constitution Party to pay off for this event. And so you can actually get your book signed, the books signed, and be able to meet like-minded people who love the Constitution and become a part of what I consider a real rising surge in politics today, and it's actually happening here in your backyard. So come be a part of this. The details regarding the location for the Republican Coffee Club, by the way, as I digressed, is actually on the ReclaimingTheRepublic.org on my links page. That's the same thing with the Ed Pace's information and so forth, the same with Grassroots. Northwest Grassroots, their movie night. And oh, by the way, if you're not driving to the Spokane Valley currently, you need to turn around and get there, because tonight is movie night with the Northwest Grassroots, and they will be talking about the Hearst decision, so that they're going to basically give you all the details. It'll be an open forum, and I believe that there'll be plenty of opportunity for people to have questions if your questions aren't already answered by the debrief and the information that's going to be presented. Please remember that these are free events to attend, so if you, you know, can add to the tip and throw that extra added tip into their little tin or their collection buckets or what have you, they would greatly appreciate it, because we absolutely need these types of services, just like this show and so forth. You need this information. When are these things happening, so that you can get informed? And so we need your help and we need your support. And I'm telling you right now, Soros is trying to shut us down. He's not trying to help us. So if you still want to get some flowers, and if one of those events are coming up, check out the Sunnyvale Flower Farm in Suncrest on Facebook and look at the details and see what's available before the flowers stop growing, because winter is coming. I basically contacted an old jarhead Marine Corps friend of mine, and it looks like we're going to start working together on my book on education. If you go to my Moby Strip Press page, I have 5 books that I am writing outside of just the We the People series of the 3 books I've written. And he's an educator, has been in education for a long time, and he was adamant that there's no way he was going to like my solution or, you know, anything other than fixing the education. And I, you know, and he didn't know how to really fix it, but he knew the charter schools and all these other things weren't truly the fix. And bottom line, the interesting thing is that he, you know, he really likes my ideas on what we need to do in taking back education. It's a part of taking back this country. So I just want to let you know that I'll be kind of working on that over the next probably year and a half, 2 years. Again, Constitution Day will be the 21st, and I just ask that on Constitution Day, the Constitution Day celebration will be the 21st. Constitution Day is the 17th. We're running promos. Please take aside some time to read the Constitution on the 17th. It's Sunday, you know, before you turn on those stupid football games and get insulted by these guys that want to protest and everything else. And I'm writing an article about this, because they're not exercising the First Amendment. They're the freedom of speech. What they're exercising is religious freedom of expression. This isn't a true speech issue. This is truly a religious exercise and so an expression. So anyway, there's one more thing before, you know, I wanted to get into, really before we get into the heartbreak and come back with Dr. Vile. I would love, and if you know a John Birch Society leader in the area or somebody that would love to talk and have an opportunity to come on this show, I would really love to have, and I want to, you know, invite them to have an opportunity to kind of talk about what the John Birchers are doing and how they, you know, have this plan, because they claim to have this plan, and I'm not necessarily going to deride them, but I look at an organization that's been around since the 50s, and I look at how close we are to being socialized and losing our Constitution and going, you know, I think you need to change your strategy. And I know they're anti-convention of states like I am. And most of them that are reasonable and objective that I talk to, that read Republican Review, they're absolutely amazed by it. But it doesn't fit their model at this point. And when will it? When, you know, the convention of states moves forward, or when we lose our Constitution? When will Republican Review fit their model? And I want them to talk about this because there seems to be this wall that I'm running into. And, you know, when you keep on repeating yourself and failing in the same way and expecting different results, they call that insane, right? And so I'm not insane. I'm not going to keep on running into the wall with the John Birch Society, but I'd love to have them come in. And so, as you can hear, we're coming up on the break. As soon as we come back, we will have Dr. Vile on. You'll definitely want to hear this, so please stay tuned, and we will be right back after this. Okay, folks, we are back, and as promised, we have Dr. John R. Vial from Middle Tennessee University back with us again. And welcome back, Dr. Vial.
Pleasure to be here.
And as we kind of terminated the last conversation, we really ran out of time, but I was really waiting this past month and a half, 2 months now, with bated breath to get your take on what you believe we need to do. And I guess there's this premise that I have the suspicion that you agree that what the federal government is doing is well outside the enumerated and the what the framers had created in the constitutional contract and what the states had actually ratified. And based on how it was sold to them, this is how it's going to go down, that we, if we want to do something, we're going to amend this. And so how do we get back, or what do we need to do to get the federal government back into the framework and scope of the Constitution?
Okay. Let me go to your premise. I think you're half right, maybe more than half. I think that there were certainly, you know, there certainly was an emphasis on the part of the Federalists supporting the Constitution on enumerated powers. Now, there was also, particularly when the Bill of Rights was adopted, there was an effort to leave some room for implied powers. So when you get to the 10th Amendment, which reserves powers to the state, it leaves out a key word that was used under the Articles of Confederation, which left open the door for some implied powers. Now, I think it's true that certainly there were Federalists, James Madison, and to a somewhat lesser degree, Thomas Jefferson among them, who were later surprised with how elastic the Necessary and Proper Clause and the couple other clauses of the Constitution had become. And you know, certainly they were arguing for closer to, I think, what the intent of the Federalist Papers was, and you know, closer to what we today would refer to as strict construction.
Right, and if I can just inject, Madison was very clear in his veto of the infrastructure, what's known as the Bonus Bill in 1817, that you could not use the Necessary and Proper Clause for anything other than the enumerated powers, and he actually in that veto, he listed all of those magical clauses that I like to call them.
Right.
The supremacy, necessary and proper, general welfare, and also the commerce clause, that those were not portals to gaining new powers, roles, or responsibilities, that the only way that they could have created, which would have been the foundation of the Department of Transportation in that bill, would have been by amending the Constitution. He actually wanted to sign that, but he says you have to go to the states. If I remember correctly, he pleaded them to go to the states and request an amendment.
Madison and Jefferson are both a little ambiguous on this. Frankly, when they were in power, they tended not to think so much that they needed amendments as they did when rivals were in power. And, you know, I'm not accusing them of being hypocritical. I think they genuinely thought, you know, we're going to make interpretations that are within the scope of what's there. It's other people that we have to worry about. The other thing with Madison, of course, is Madison had initially opposed the establishment of the National Bank, which was, you know, McCulloch versus Maryland was later the decision which probably did the most to enhance implied powers in our history.
With Marshall's ruling, yes.
Right, John Marshall's ruling, which didn't come actually till 1819, which would be at post-Madison. But when Madison was president, even though the first bank had lapsed during the War of 1812, the government decided that they needed an institution like this, and he supported it on the basis, basically, of precedent, that, you know, we had already argued this in the Washington administration. He had been on the losing side, but that's, you know, but
well,
the issue had basically been resolved. Now, when Andrew Jackson came into office, Jackson took a completely different view and said, I don't care what Marshall decided, I have an independent decision to make as president, and as President Jackson, of course, oppose the establishment of or reestablishment of the bank.
Of the bank,
or recontinuation,
right.
I guess I should say.
Right, but in the Assumption Act, which is when you're talking about when the implied was being sold, Madison was really clear that those implied powers didn't exist when he was debating with Hamilton. And if I remember correctly, the only reason he basically shut down his argument against it and just kind of let it happen was at a very long begging and pleading by Thomas Jefferson, who had ulterior motives because there was a compromise that was floated to getting this thing passed. And that compromise was to move the seat of government to what we knew now as Washington, D.C.
That's right. That's right. There's believed to have been a dinner that Madison hosted between Hamilton and Jefferson in which this deal was sort of made. That's exactly right.
Right. And it was all about land speculation, where Jefferson saw the opportunity of going, well, if I buy up a bunch of land, and Washington kind of liked that too, because they were both land speculators.
They weren't the only ones.
Right.
If you want a big win, go to James Wilson, and there are several others.
Yes.
A couple of whom went bankrupt basically over this.
Okay,
yes.
But back to my premise on...
I'm sorry, that's the professor in me wandering about.
And I'm with you on this, because it's a very intricate thing. But
it is. It,
in his very last act, in that bonus bill veto, that was his act as a president that basically said you cannot use these things, that they only apply to enumerated powers. So anyway, going back to what you believe we could do or we need to do or should do to get the...
Well, I mean, a lot of it goes to the electorate, quite frankly. We may be even more conflicted sometimes than Jefferson and Madison were in that we want conflicting goals. And, you know, particularly on the issue of federalism, which is, you know, what are proper powers for the states, what are those for the nation, we often find that people take contrary positions that seem more related to issues other than federalism. And probably the best example of this is the sanctuary cities issue right now.
Right.
So traditionally, I mean, it's hard to know who what side is which, but you could pretty well argue that sanctuary cities gives local cities and states the power to formulate what policies they think are best for them. But you have a Republican president and Congress who are basically saying, no, this is out of accord with a national policy that we want to pursue in restricting immigration.
Which was delegated to the federal government, clearly in the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 8.
It's not quite that clear. There's the power of naturalization is given to Congress.
Right.
But on who you can, you know, on just who can you have in your state without necessarily giving citizenship requirement, I don't think you can pin that down quite as closely. But again, I mean, you could try to tie it. You certainly could try to tie it.
I think there's a better chance.
Congressional power over naturalization.
I think there's a better chance of tying that than healthcare, education, energy, and all of these other things.
Well, and of course, you know, there have been three great transformations of the Constitution. You know, one is the Civil War, and the primary transition there is widening the rights that are protected, you know, by the national government. Then you get, you know, the Progressive Era, where we get, you know, the 17th Amendment, which I think we're going to talk about,
right?
You know, national income tax and the like. And then, of course, the biggest has been the New Deal, which is then sort of reaffirmed in Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and whatever. And I think what you find with, you know, with any governmental programs is once they get established, they are extremely difficult to root out because they have their own constituency. And again, you know, to take a contemporary example, you know, what is the national government's role in natural disaster? It's hard to say from just reading the Constitution. I mean, you know, there's national defense to some degree a hurricane or typhoon, you know,
right.
an event like this, a
okay.
series of tornadoes, that they certainly deal with domestic tranquility.
Well, let me cut you off right there real quick, because
sure.
we got a hard break coming up, and we'll
okay,
get
great.
Back into the domestic tranquility as soon as we get back, folks. Stay tuned,
okay.
please. Okay, folks, we are back with Dr. Vile. Thank you for holding on. And you were speaking of domestic tranquility, but before you get into finishing your thought, I know you have a JD, so I know you're really good at, you know, setting up arguments and so forth. But
I'm going to stop you there because I have a PhD.
I
have not been tainted with a law degree.
Oh, I thought you had a JD from.
No, I do most of my writing in the law, but I had a subfield in political science that dealt with judicial process and constitutional law, but I don't have a JD.
Oh, okay.
So you'll have to attribute my argumentativeness to. Either my marital situation or my training in debate and mock trial. I'm not sure.
Which is, and that's true. You've got extensive.
I was a debater in college, and I coached mock trial here for 25 years, and I've had some good success with it.
But before you get back into that, I wanted to circle back real quick before
okay.
I lose my train of thought.
Sure.
That you basically asserted that the Constitution has gone through three shifts, and these are shifts of paradigms. They're not shifts of contract, because the 14th Amendment may have broadened the application of privileges, immunities, and what some people call due process and those types of things, but it
sure.
didn't open up any new doors in creating the federal government. In other words, they basically, from that point forward, if I remember correctly, started using statutes and regulations to moving things the way they wanted, and creating changes to the Electoral College and so forth. That's when they started using statutes and or regulations instead of following the precedents that they went out the gate with in amending the Constitution.
Well, you had four amendments, of course, during the Progressive Era.
Absolutely. But those amendments, again, are only applicable to the changes that they made, whether that be the 17th Amendment or the 16th Amendment. It didn't basically
right.
say, oh, and by the way, down the road, we're going to be able to grant ourselves any other powers without having to follow the Article 5 process.
Right. And again, the ones that I mentioned that, well, the other main one that I mentioned is the New Deal, and that is the most subject to what you're saying here. There was literally, unless it would be that, lame duck. Basically, it left no constitutional imprint that sort of reflected the changes in the scope of governmental activity.
I mean, right.
You know, the ABCs of all the governmental programs that were introduced, you know, have perpetuated themselves without a constitutional amending base.
Okay, so
let me
throw this paradigm of history, because I think you'll agree with me that the ratification debates were pretty much obscured. I mean, as we talked before, that they came out, I think, in the 1840s. So we today, now that we actually have access to them because of the beauty of the internet, it's not like those things were ever published, put in every library, put in every state, and so forth. They were kind of left in obscurity. And so the understanding of what was really defined as the limitations of the Constitution was obscured for such a long time that during these Progressive Era and the New Deal and so forth, we had to rely upon these great minds that have been building case law, constitutional law, precedents, and so forth. And I'll just use the word, we were duped. We were duped from the very beginning with some of the arguments that Marshall made and so forth. And so I assert that now that we have the true fidelity, it's kind of like if I bought a, you know, one of these mind game pictures that out of a garage sale. And right. I said, you know, I just want to buy this for the frame. And I pay the kid $5 and I take it home and I, you know, take the frame off. And lo and behold, behind this is a classic work of art that was family owned and it was stolen, you know, 100 and some years sure. ago. And all of a sudden I say, hey, I've got this and it's worth a lot of money. Well, actually, I don't have it. It still belongs to somebody else because that is a possession. That's property. And just like the powers, roles, and responsibilities were delineated, and as Nichols said in the ratification debates of Virginia, that when we only delegate a certain amount of property, because I think he talked about 1,000 acres, and if I gave 500 acres to the federal government or we delegate these powers, do I have to do a new deed on the power or the state or the property that I still possess? And I'm paraphrasing, of course, but he says,
right.
No, I don't have to because I still own that. And so that right. these roles, responsibilities were property of the states, and the federal government duped us. And I'm taking a lot of latitude here.
I guess the qualification I would add is that in many ways, first, the chronology is not quite right, but close. I mean, we got Madison's notes of the convention at about 1840.
Right.
Many of the debates within the states were published in the papers contemporaneously. They are now being collected in a 30-40 volume set done by University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
A great
mm-hmm.
work. But in some sense, I'd almost have to say that we were, I mean, I don't know that I'd use the word deuce, but we have been willing participants in this. We have, for better or worse, and I'm certainly, you know, I'm familiar with the arguments and not insensitive to those that say we've gone too far, but we have faced crises in our history where we have been willing to, I don't know, look the other way when it comes to explicit constitutional foundations for them and looked at the particular case at hand. And, you know, you see this, I'm finishing a book right now on disaster relief in the United States. And early in our history, we had intense debates over, you know, whether it was proper for Congress to appropriate any money for anybody that, you know, that was a particular area or a particular place as opposed to something that applied overall. And over time, we have had less such arguments, and the arguments tend to be more about how much aid shall we give and what conditions shall we put with it. And, you know, is the aid that we're giving likely, as in the case of some of these hurricane insurance, is it likely to lead to future, you know, disasters, you know, down the road?
Right. Right. But I guess what I'm saying, and let me change the gears a little bit and let's look at this as, let's say we move forward. Let's say I actually have this charisma, this power of influence that I can actually get a state, South Dakota, North Dakota, if you're listening, Wyoming, you know, a state that is a true bastion of conservative thought and recognizes that the Constitution is way out of line. And they actually come to the, you know, the realization or agree with me that they do have the power to audit the Constitution and to step up and say, federal government, we never gave you these things. We never, through the Article 5 process, you were running us into ruin and so forth. So they move forward with this audit and they make the appeal. And I assert that what Jefferson and Madison did with the resolutions in their appeal, because clearly they didn't try to amend the Constitution to, you know, to redo or undo the Sedition Acts. They appealed to the other states to say, this is unconstitutional. You're going to let this actually happen? And and so they were trying to coalesce the states instead of convening
right,
an Article 5.
And what happened, of course, there is they couldn't get any other states to go along with them. Now, what was more successful is they did win the election of 1800.
Right.
And they began a more, you know, restrictive view of the powers of the national government.
Sure.
But they never actually got any other states to go along with the Virginia and Kentucky resolution.
Right. And what happened was they let the genie out of the bottle on nullification. But what my point is let's say I get, and I believe the sentiment in these conservative states, these strong, hard red states, flyover states, let's call them. But I believe the sentiment is such that when they wake up and they realize that they still possess the authority and the power of the Constitution, I don't think it's going to be just one or two states. I believe that we're probably, how many states challenge just Obamacare? And how many states are challenging the fact that, you know, this federal government is in spend out of control danger of us going into, you know, a real financial crisis and what have you. So if all of a sudden I have 15, 20, 30 states, maybe even 34 states that say we want to audit this Constitution, what do you believe is, you know, going to happen? And again, I've said this before, I'm not looking for an Article 5 or making any changes. I'm just trying to get back to enforcement or forcing the federal government to say, okay, we believe we need to do these things, and here's amendments to do them. We're going to get back into following this thing. And to me, I'd be
very happy.
Yeah,
and I mean, you had a little bit of this in to go back to the FDR.
But let me give you a couple of minutes. We're going to go to break here, and so I want you to ruminate in answering that, and the floor will be yours, sir. As I'm expecting to hear some music coming up, and actually there it is. See, I'm clairvoyant on time maybe, but anyway. Doctors, please stay tuned, folks. We're going to be right back, and the doctor will be able to answer this perpetuating problem that I think we have. Thank you very much, and stay tuned. Okay, and thank you for staying tuned, folks. We still have the good doctor. So, Professor, now that you've had time, what do you believe is going to happen if these states feel like they're so disenfranchised and they feel like there's no other resolve but to step up and audit the Constitution? The floor is yours, sir.
You know, I guess if I had the choice, I would say it would be better to try to do an Article 5 convention. If you know what you want to do is to change the Constitution, and you have some proposals, put them out there, try to get them discussed. What I think is, I think the problem with the audit is I think that there are shortcuts. I think it's much more likely that people are going to, you know, they're going to look to the next election, either at the state level or the national level, and say, you know, well, the last bums we elected, they didn't do it, but this group is going to. And for every person that you think, you know, that thinks that the Constitution has gone too far, you're probably going to have another who thinks that the government ought to be doing more, whether it's in health care or in regard to immigration control or disaster relief or whatever. So, I would encourage anybody who wants to get encouraged in involved in government to do this, but I just... If we haven't done an audit like this after 200 and some years, it seems unlikely that we would do it now.
And the reason is we're actually gaining access to documents that have been, like I said, obscured because of technology. The only way you could have really read the ratification debates is possibly going back to the states and going through their archives of the newspapers or what have you. And I would just find it very...
Well, I can put a perspective on it that's interesting. It's not certainly definitive.
And as you do, I will give you the next problem coming down the pike when you're done.
Okay. One of the interesting things about James Madison, who was, you know, is often called the father of the Constitution,
yep,
probably had as much to do with it as anyone, is he did not want his papers published during his lifetime, because he did not think that that was the appropriate way to interpret the Constitution. He thought he thought that whatever was decided in debate, the primary thing we ought to be doing is looking at what do the words actually say, and what did they, you know, probably with a caveat, what did they mean at the time that they were written.
Sure, and I absolutely
agree
with that.
I'm not sure, I think he might say is, as valuable to historians and political scientists as these documents are, that train has sort of left the station. We, you know, by 1840, we had already pretty much established what principles of constitutional construction were going to be, and he seemed, I mean, he wasn't always satisfied with them, but it was like he thought that was a better way than going back and reading, I'll say, musty documents. I don't know if they're musty or not. They're not to me, because I love them. But yeah. Anyway.
But so I absolutely agree with Madison's position, because it infuriates me when people try to bring up some of Madison's artistic license or latitudes that he took in asserting his biases in his notes on the convention. It's not so. What I believe is relative.
I have to defend a fellow Virginian here.
Oh, okay.
I'm familiar with those criticisms, and I don't think they're particularly valid. But that's another story for another day.
No, so if I was arguing in the Supreme Court on this case, over the auditing and so forth, when you get into things that happen in a vacuum, whether it's a journal or so forth, it's different than when it actually happens as an official document. A good example of that is the thank you response back to the Danbury Baptist by Thomas Jefferson, and that little line of the separation of church and state,
right,
that was never intended to be an official document. But the veto message back to Congress was an official document. The ratification debates and what was said on that floor was in official capacity. So it's nice to have these little, you know, insights of Madison, Jefferson, and these letters back and forth. But to me, they hold nothing other than opinion or hearsay. And the only thing we really have to go on is what did they actually do? And so those resolutions of Kentucky and Virginia are hard, tangible things that they actually stood up and said, you're violating the Constitution, you can't do this. And what they said in an official capacity, to me, holds water. And there's lots of other really good supporting documents that I, you know, would agree with my argument, but I have to leave those on the table and say, you know, that wasn't in an official capacity. That was done in a vacuum.
Yeah, no, I'm working on a book right now on the Declaration of Independence, and there are all kinds of people who say, well, Jefferson couldn't really have meant a creator God because Jefferson was a deist or this or that. Well, he was writing a public document. And it doesn't particularly matter what Mr. Jefferson
believed, right,
confided to friends. It's what did he say in the document?
Right, right. And that's true, because in his confidential letters to James, or not James, but to John Adams, he basically, you know, bore his soul in his religious beliefs. And it's interesting how people ignore those things and call him a deist or what have you. But that all aside, you're right. Those are personal things. And, you know, I actually wrote about this in my first book about Jefferson's religious views. I know you've possibly skimmed over it. You may want to read it again.
Yes, it is.
Because
okay.
He was really moved by a book that was written by Sir Isaac Newton. It was the observations on the revelations of Daniel and the apocalypse. And so that book really had a huge impact on his religious views after that, because here's Sir Isaac Newton, a guy he absolutely respected, saying that he didn't believe any of the true churches existed, and he was committing heresy by writing that book.
He was. There's a recent book on Newton that just came out, and he was definitely, I mean, he believed deeply in Scripture, but he definitely had heretical views by comparison to the established church. And of course,
at that point in time,
Bacon, Locke, and Newton were the three people that Jefferson said you thought were the most important in world history.
Right. Yes. And they were challenging the church's authority of coronation and so forth. But here we go.
Divine right.
We've definitely gone down another tangent and rat hole.
Well, that's what happens when you talk to a professor.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time. But going back to this, what happens, you know, and I know you've probably prefer the process. But I, to me, the audit draws a line and says you can't do this, because down the pike, they're going to create a Department of Babysitting. They're going to, it's going to branch out of the Health and Human Services Department, because Hillary's already talked about this. It's already been floated that the state wants to basically start assigning a worker for when a woman finally chooses to go to term with a pregnancy, then that woman is going to be assigned a social worker. And then it's not just going to delivering the child, but she actually, if you've read her book, It Takes a Village, she wants the state involved to ensure that the child does not get introduced into dogma, you know, from religious dogma and so forth in the home. In other words, they're going to start mandating that you can't teach your kids religion and some of these things that, you know, are against what secularism they're ramming down our throats.
Well, there, I think we're protected adequately by the First Amendment, but after the last several years, I'm not so sure of anything anymore.
I believe that the Constitution, because it's a contract, we're protected. And if we draw the line and stand up and say, you cannot do it without our permission, it makes it a much harder. And that's what Madison knew. The electorate needed to be protected from themselves, because they would instantly walk down this path of, oh, we need to be fed, feed us now. And then they would surrender something to do that. And sure, he knew that the electorate, he didn't say nice things about them, but he really was... Wade, I believe.
That was an age where you could tell the truth without getting electorally defeated. Yes. Now we seem to have to pander.
Yes, it could be in Twitter sphere pretty quickly. And
yes, it could.
And so the big thing to me, and I know we're going to be coming up on a hard break, but the big thing to me is that they did create a system, because it was a hard, fast document that I believe that was the divine wisdom that, you know, they recognized, because all the framers asserted that they were inspired by the divine hand of providence, so much so that the very first thing that they did was they demanded, or they basically requested, that Washington make a proclamation of Thanksgiving that you're aware of. And I think that was an absolute recognition that they felt that this was a much greater thing than they could have ever have come up with. And by giving...
And that's where their deism actually doesn't seem very consistent. This is particularly true, by the way, of Benjamin Franklin, who usually sort of, you know, God's a creator and that's it, but he does at different times. And Washington certainly, you know, at different times... attributes to providence, you know, what I guess was pretty extra, you know, we forget how extraordinary it was, basically, to achieve independence of what was the world's, you know, greatest colonial power at the time.
Here's the interesting thing, Dr. Professor, we're actually at the end of the show, so this is our third segment, and if you would please stay on, I want to record so that we can actually extend this into another show, because it's worth it to me, if you got the time, if that's
sure.
Okay. Thank you so much, folks. Stay tuned. We'll be back next week, and hopefully we'll have the doctor in these next segments. Have a good one, and God bless.